History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold. It's up to us to ask enough questions and invest enough time in listening that not only we get to hear some of these stories, but allow them to add to our perspective. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're educated, we're entertained, but the real gold comes when we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Of the more than 16 million Americans who served in World War II, less than one half of 1% of them are still with us today, less than 60,000, according to recent estimates. But for those who are still here, 2025 has been full of 80th anniversaries, and a very significant one is coming up this week. If you happen to be in Washington, D.C. this week, the National World War II Memorial will host a special 80th anniversary commemoration of VE Day on Thursday, May 8th at 11 a.m. Those of us who can't be there can stream that ceremony live online, 80 years from the day the Nazi regime officially surrendered to Allied forces, triggering relief and jubilation with the news that victory in Europe was secure. I know what a relief it was that day for my grandfather, who by that time had taken part in the liberation of Buchenwald concentration camp after surviving the Battle of the Bulge, and before that he earned a Silver Star for pulling 26 people out of burning tanks. His most vivid VE Day memory was seeing a sign outside a German church and translating the words into English, "The air raid shelter is in the sun." If you let that one sink in for a moment, you'll grasp a little bit of what kind of difference that victory in Europe meant for the people who had lived in chaos for years. We're going to hear several veterans' VE Day-related memories today, but let's start with what you would have heard over some of these very same radio airwaves 80 years ago from a commander-in-chief who had been on the job for less than a month at that point, Harry Truman.
This is a solemn but a glorious hour. I only wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to witness this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe. For this victory, we join in offering our thanks to the Providence which has guided and sustained us through the dark days of adversity. And now I want to read to you my formal proclamation of this occasion. The Allied armies, through sacrifice and devotion, and with God's help, have wrung from Germany a final and unconditional surrender. The Western world has been freed of the evil forces which for 5 years and longer have imprisoned the bodies and broken the lives of millions upon millions of freeborn men. They have violated their churches, destroyed their homes, corrupted their children, and murdered their loved ones. Our armies of liberation have restored freedom to these suffering people, whose spirit and will the oppressors could never enslave. United, the peace-loving nations have demonstrated in the West that their arms are stronger by far than the might of the dictators or the tyranny of military cliques. The power of our peoples to defend themselves against all enemies will be proved in the Pacific War as it has been proved in Europe. For the triumph of spirit and of arms which we have won, and for its promise to the peoples everywhere who join us in the love of freedom, it is fitting that we, as a nation, give thanks to Almighty God, who has strengthened us and given us the victory. Now, therefore, I, Harry S. Truman, President of the United States of America, do hereby appoint Sunday, May 13th, 1945, to be a day of prayer. I call upon the people of the United States, whatever their faith, to unite in offering joyful thanks to God for the victory we have won, and to pray that He will support us to the end of our present struggle and guide us into the ways of peace. I also call upon my countrymen to dedicate this day of prayer to the memory of those who have given their lives to make possible our victory.
80 years ago this week, on May 8th, 1945. We're going to hear another clip from that day in a bit, but most of our time today will be spent with the memories of men and women whose lives changed on VE Day. Like Luis Rodriguez, who could never forget the day the war started. He was on a ladder picking oranges in California's San Joaquin Valley when he heard the news about Pearl Harbor. 3.5 years later, he had survived the Battle of the Bulge and more with the 240th Field Artillery Battalion in Europe.
May the 1st. That morning, early in the morning, we fired our last shot. It was one of those wet days. It had been snowing, and of course, it was warmer weather. The snow was melting and made the ground very, very muddy. But we were supporting the 14th Armored Division, a good division, and along with the 99th Infantry Division. And they were, some of their troops more or less stayed where we were at. And we were wondering, what in the world's going on? We're not moving, no orders, no nothing. So what had happened was that the front was moving so fast that the armored division no longer needed us, so they retired us from duty, and we were told to go back and establish a place to stay until we were called. And knowing what was going on, we knew better. That we had fired our last shot in Europe, and that's the way it was.
You have a frame of General Dwight Eisenhower's order of the day from May 5th, 1945, when he talks about the crusade that the Allies had been on since the summer of 44, reaching its glorious conclusion. Do you remember hearing those words or reading those words from your commander and feeling anything specific about that?
I sure do. I'll never forget that day. It was an article in we used to get a newspaper whenever we could get it, Stars and Stripes newspaper, and on it was, in the front page, was this letter written from General Eisenhower, and it was something that we had dreamed up for 9 months, and here the day had arrived that all guns had gone to rest and we no longer needed to fire anything, and we wondered what our next duties would be, and it didn't take us long to find out we were pulled into occupation of Germany.
Many Americans would participate in the occupation of Germany. Many would be sent to the Pacific Theater or home to train for the Pacific. Filda Brodalski had cared for some of the wounded in the Normandy invasion. She had joined the Army right after the attack on Pearl Harbor, where her older sister was a nurse when the Japanese attacked. Her entire family had been all in for the war effort for years, so the defeat of the Third Reich was significant.
We were in Leipzig, Germany, when the war ended. We were on an air base, a German air base, in the barracks there. And I think we were all relieved. I know that they brought some wax in on an airplane, and that night the hospital celebrated all over the place because we were happy. Finally, it was over, you know. And then it was a slow trip back home.
And how many siblings did you have serving in one part of the war or another?
Oh, I had a brother who was in the Navy, and I had a brother who was in Pan American Airlines, and they were drafted in to bring the supplies to Europe. And then I had an older sister who was a nurse who joined the Red Cross and took care of things on the home front. We made it back home without being wounded, too. That's another thing. I mean, we were in the middle of it, like Lee in Hawaii, but we didn't get hurt ourselves.
And after everything you saw in your personal experience, you know the odds of all four coming home with nothing is
rare. Very rare. No, I consider our family was lucky. Even my father became a guard at the gun factory because he wanted to do his part.
American families were all in, while for so many families in Europe, it had been an all-out nightmare. I mentioned that the National World War II Memorial will host an 80th anniversary VE Day ceremony on May 8th. Last week, they had a program featuring prolific World War II author Alex Kershaw focused on the liberation of concentration camps, specifically Dachau, where Dan Doherty happened to be with the 45th Infantry Division.
We had entered through an opening. It wasn't a gate. We didn't enter through the a main gate. We're just kind of an opening. And at that opening, Lieutenant Penny, our platoon leader, said, "Okay, guys, fan out and look for guards." Well, in retrospect, you realize how silly this was. This is 25 acres, the compound, the dock compound. Yeah. And we're a platoon of maybe 20 guys. Fan out over 25 acres. Well, fan out we did. Some of the guys went to the right, and some went straight ahead, and I and a few others went to the left. We've just walked by 39 boxcars, and then we get into the turn to the left, and we come, and here's a whole bunch of corpses lying on the ground, and who's standing around looking at them? About a dozen civilian reporters. The Army knew where Dachau was, and in anticipation of the liberation, they had assembled this media group behind the lines. They've already brought them in. People are still looking for guards. I'm sorry, in retrospect, I never talked to any one of them. They were newspaper guys from all over the Allied world, Australia and South Africa and the United States. While we're there, one of our guys, I didn't see this, I was doing something else. One of these guys crawled over the corpses of the guards, cut off a finger, because he wanted the SS ring for a souvenir. And what I heard was one of the guards, one of the reporters, like, "Hey, you can't do that." Well, he'd already done it. I'm telling you this because you're not supposed to shoot unarmed prisoners of war with hands over their head. So when they learned that something like that had happened at Dachau, there was an investigation. And we have the report, and the report mentions that in the coal yard there were 17 bodies and two of them had fingers missing. And I learned about 5 years ago who got the second ring. It was another sergeant in our company. But I spent my entire time around the coal yard, and just over the wall from it was the SS hospital for the SS. Mm-hmm. And I walked through that. It was all empty. I think I company went in there and just emptied it. We had guys out looking. There were all kinds of buildings. The guys had to go into all those buildings and search every room and make certain they weren't letting some guards get behind. And then it turns dark. Our platoon ends up spending the night in one of the homes that had housed one of the senior SS officers. Lovely flower gardens out in front. And inside you had upholstered furniture, much nicer than just an ordinary thing. We knew we had seen something mind-boggling. And we talked until midnight. And hearing the other guys, they'd had much different experiences from me. Some of them had gotten to the compound where the prisoners were. Others had been to the crematorium. And see, I had missed all that. And so I was bound and determined to get out there in the first thing in the morning and have a look around. Well, it turns out, I've often always wondered why we never did guard duty at Dachau that night. That's the only time we were anywhere near the front lines. We didn't do guard duty. And I learned afterwards that we had gone in to relieve I Company, but then that evening things were changed. I Company was determined was just a basket case and was unable to return to fighting. And so they brought in another company, I think L Company, to relieve them, and they relieved us. And so we didn't have to do the guard duty that night. And we're out of there before dawn the next morning to catch up, because I've learned afterwards that the other platoons of C Company, once they were relieved, hiked back to the town of Dachau and slept there that night. Why we slept in the camp, I don't know. But we had some catching up to do. That was about a mile away. And we're walking very briskly to catch up on the morning. And this is now April 30th. We're approaching Munich, and all of a sudden we come to a picket fence. It's about 7 feet high, and if nothing had happened, we would have just walked on by, but it turned out to be the perimeter of the largest of the Dachau subcamps, was called Alloch, A-L-L-A-C-H. And all of a sudden, the prisoners realized we were the U.S. Army, and the celebration began. And there are no guards, and there are no corpses. It's a totally different experience than the day before. And the first thing we do is give them all of our K rations, give them all our cigarettes, all our candy. There was a potato cellar there, and we let them out to get the potatoes. And then our officers said, hey, you can't let them out. They had to keep them in there. They were afraid they would, if they got out, they'd start running around the whole community. And so we got the potatoes, and we threw them over the fence. And one of our guys threw a cigar over the fence. There was the darndest fight. And when that fight was over, the cigar was in shreds. So we didn't do that anymore. But we were there for maybe 2-3 hours. I talked to an older prisoner. He told me he was a physician from Warsaw. He said that because he was a doctor, he had been treated deferentially, and they let him actually even be a doctor. You know, he didn't have any equipment or anything. But we were relieved after 2 or 3 hours and then resumed the march on Munich. But an interesting thing happened there. One of our sergeants befriended one of the prisoners that day who talked English. They talked for about an hour. About 3 days later, we get to Munich that day. We're approaching Munich with great apprehension. We think it's going to be another Nuremberg, or we'd had 3 guys killed. It turns out that along the way we learned that the early units of the 45th and the 42nd had met very little resistance. And so we knew we just hiked right into Munich. Well, about 3 days later, this prisoner shows up in Munich. He just walks away from Alloch. Uh-huh. And he wants to join C Company and fight the Germans. Wow. It's the last week of the war. But and so Sergeant Bill puts a uniform on him. And for the 4 months of that summer, he functioned as a member. It was Anton Dvorsky. He went all the way to France with us, almost got on the ship with us to come home. And Bill thought that, I don't, maybe we shouldn't do that. Well, the guy emigrates to America afterwards. One of Bill's guys in New York helps him find his father. His father had abandoned the family in Budapest, and he found his father and reconciled with him. He married, had a very good business, and at his wedding, they met a guy who had been a guard at Alloch. He had befriended him as a prisoner, kept in touch with him after the war, and sent him an airline ticket to come to his wedding. Well, he had a very good relationship with Bill that whole time in America, just from that hour that started at Alloch. And I'm still in contact with that fellow's cousin. She lives up in Portland, and she's active in the Jewish community up there, and she's still doing a lot of research on the family. Well, then on the, it's now the 30th of April, and we arrived that night right in downtown Munich, and the next morning, May 1st, it's immediately announced the 45th Division will occupy Munich. And that meant for us the war is over.
The war was over in Europe 80 years ago this week. The liberation of all of those concentration camps and the bigger picture of the tyranny and terror that the Allies put an end to is a powerful testament to why VE Day is a day to remember. But there was personal significance for each individual veteran as well, and we'll hear more of those stories when this special edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode dedicated to VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, May 8th, 1945. We're letting you know this weekend so you can tune in or participate in the 80th anniversary ceremonies at the National World War II Memorial or elsewhere on Thursday, May 8th. 80 years ago, on some of these same radio airwaves, you might have heard these words from Supreme Allied Commander General Dwight D. Eisenhower.
I have the proud privilege of speaking for a victorious army of almost 5 million fighting men. They and the women who have so ably assisted them constitute the Allied expeditionary forces that have liberated Western Europe. They have captured or destroyed enemy armies totaling more than their own strength. Merely to name my principal subordinates in the Canadian, French, American, and British forces is to present a picture of the utmost in efficiency, skill, loyalty, and devotion to duty. The United Nations will gratefully remember Tedder, Montgomery, Spots, Bradley, DeLotte, Creer, and many others. But all these agree with me in the selection of the truly heroic figure of this war. He is G.I. Joe and his counterpart in the Air, the Navy, and the merchant marine of every one of the United Nations. He has braved the dangers of U-boat infested seas. He has surmounted charges into desperately defended beaches. He has fought his tedious, patient way through the ultimate in fortified zones. He has endured cold, hunger, fatigue. His companion has been danger. Death has dogged his footsteps. He and his platoon commanders have given us an example of loyalty, devotion to duty, and indomitable courage that will live in our hearts as long as we admire those qualities in men.
So let's hear from some more of those guys General Eisenhower was talking about 80 years ago, like Phil Benson, who had come ashore on Omaha Beach on D-Day 11 months earlier. May 8th would come to carry much more pleasant memories than June 6th.
Rumors start spreading, the war is over. And I said, where in the world did that come from? And as soon as we got on the street, there were just thousands of French women with loaves of bread, La Guerre Finie. And that was...
The war is over.
Yeah. And that was an emotional thing for me.
Did any of those French women plant a kiss on you?
Not me. We were marching down the street. I wouldn't have refused one.
Sure. Did you think the war was over for you, or did you wonder, I might still have something to do?
Oh, I thought it was over, but I didn't think that I'd be going home the next day. They took us and sent us to where the Germans still had submarine pens, and they never gave up, and they were still there. So we formed the perimeter around the Germans, and we were facing out to keep the French from going back in. So we did that for a week or whatever, and then we left, and they sent us to Germany. I was glad that it ended. I can't get over it. I can't tell you the joy I heard when they said the war was over. I can't describe it.
And they even said it in French.
Oh, yeah, La Guerre Finie.
Some of the celebrating servicemen had been fighting for years, others just a matter of weeks. But the news of victory was just as welcome. Sam Terasaki was a 20-year-old mortarman with the 100th Infantry Battalion, also known as the Purple Heart Battalion. It had been attached to the 442nd Regimental Combat Team.
You know, as an infantryman or Mortimer, you don't get the latest news. In fact, some of the old-timers knew that the war was going to end then. We never knew that.
When did you figure it out, and what did it mean to you?
Didn't believe it. We were in a town northern Italy after we had captured a number of Germans and had them on the run. I was in a town, spent a miserable night in this town square, rained all night, covered myself with my shelter half, and woke up in the morning and all kinds of native Italians running around said the war is over. I didn't believe them, but it was shortly after that an observation plane flew over and dumped the bundles of the Stars and Stripes and said the war is over. That's when I knew.
How big of a relief was that?
Oh, you don't. I remember none of the guys jumped up and down or anything. It just kind of took it as a matter of fact. We were happy that it was over, and it was a day or two later we had a memorial service at an abandoned warehouse. Our chaplain delivered a sermon and read the names of all the guys in the 100th from the first one that was killed down in Salerno. Very sad. Couldn't help from crying.
I believe it. And I'm sure, even though, as you're telling it, there was only about a month that you spent in real intense combat, that had to be the longest month of your life, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And sure, there had to be days in there where you thought your name could have been one of those in the chaplain's reading.
Well, I may have wondered why I'd survived and the others didn't.
Did you have days where you thought that was going to be it? Did you?
Oh, sure, yeah. Pray to God when we're under artillery fire that the next one wouldn't come over and hit us.
It's got to be a pretty helpless feeling.
It is. What do? Put your hands over your head and hug the ground as much as you can and hope that you don't get hit. I know I recited the Lord's Prayer all the time.
I'm just imagining being in those shoes and how lonely and scary and just difficult that must have been.
It was. It was scary. When your legs start shaking, you can't stop it from shaking. That's when I knew I was scared.
And you mentioned that memorial service while you're still there in Italy, and the war has just ended, and they're reading off name after Japanese surname. Some of those guys are probably guys you knew?
Yeah.
And you told, you're crying.
Yeah.
How should we today remember those guys whose names you heard read that day?
Well, I don't know. I just live a good life. Pay them back by living a good life and being tolerant.
The next veteran we're going to hear from is Jim Gerhardt of the 736th Medium Tank Battalion. Before we hear why his location on May 8, 1945 was so meaningful, we need to hear what he went through 10 weeks earlier on February 25th.
We hit a couple of anti-personnel mines, which just shake you up a little is all. It's a little startling, but it doesn't hurt anything. Tank commander stopped the tank to assist somebody else, and about that time we took a round, a German round, 88, through the engine compartment. As I found out later from a retriever, the round came through the engine compartment, right down the dead center of the two engines, the two Cadillac engines, took off all the spark plugs, went through the firewall into the turret, and then exploded inside the turret where we were sitting. You don't remember anything about an explosion. You get a big red flash, your ears start ringing. You don't really feel any pain. You don't really know what happened either. And I know when I came to, I knew that I'd been hit, of course, but the explosion ripped open my jacket zipper. I didn't get blinded right then, but my eyes burned, of course. My ears were still ringing. In one hand, I had a glove on for handling hot shells. And one gland was bare, and when the shell went off, it was only 2 feet away or so. So my left side got pretty well tore apart, and the tank commander, he was on the other side of the turret. His right side got all tore up because he was on the opposite side. The gunner who was in front of it was only about a foot from the explosion. He was killed. The driver right in front of him was also killed. The turret raised in the air and came back down and trapped the assistant driver inside the tank, so he was stuck there, and there was no way to get him out, and so he burned to death in the tank. I finally got out through the turret, because I left my turret open, because I considered that 5/8 inch of armor on the tank is not going to stop anything coming through anyway, and so I went out to the top, and I discovered two men, engineers, on the back of our tank. And so I pulled them off the tank and took them with me out into 105 hole out in the middle of the field to wait for medics. And while we're out there, they kept throwing mortar shells and a few rounds of 88s out in the field. And a couple of them, two mortar shells landed alongside of us, and both of them duds. But then one of the bombs went off, and it blew another hole not too far from us, and some of the fragments came down and burned us from that. That was about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, and we were out there till almost 5 that afternoon before the medics, well, I can't say the medics because it wasn't the medics that came after us. Our own people came after us. We didn't have any medics come out after us. And they took us back to the aid station. Of course, by this time, I know I got a leg busted up and bad, and I had a tournament on it. And I doctored up the other two guys with sulfur drugs to keep them from getting infected or poisoned. And they evacuated them too, and they took me back to an aid station. And they gave me a nice shot of morphine, which I made me feel pretty good. Then they put me on a jeep. Oh, when they was picking me up, they put me on a board. They didn't have a stretcher. They put me on a board. And when they did, they twisted my leg, and which was quite painful. And if there was any new cuss words invented, I invented them that day. And they probably could have heard me as far as Berlin, because I was really upset. And they got me back to the aid station. They fixed me up there a little bit. They put me on a jeep. They also put blankets around me because I was freezing. And it was cold. It was in February morning. It was February 25th, yeah. And it was still freezing weather. And so when I got on this jeep, they put one blanket over me, and it took about a mile before that blanket was gone. So by the time I got to the hospital in Liège, Belgium, I was almost frozen again. And then they put me on a stretcher to take me up to the room where they put you in to put you in line to be the next operated on. They had a buzz bomb come over, which was a German, kind of a jet air, gasoline jet engine thing. And it exploded. It landed and exploded in the courtyard of the hospital. And the German prisoners, they dropped me. And so I skidded all the way down the stairs, bounced from step to step down a whole flight of stairs. And they finally got me upstairs and they put me in the hallway. By this time, of course, I'm blind. I can't see anything. Can't hear much either. So I heard somebody ask me if I wanted a cigarette. And of course, I said, sure. I didn't know if I could smoke or not, since most of my face, my left side of my face was burned and my hands were burned, a few other things. And they had already cut my helmet off because it was burned in my head. So they had to cut it off already. Then somebody asked me a cigarette, and later I found out it was the movie star Van Johnson that had offered me this cigarette. Then I remember going into the operating room, and they had us all in cots there, and they took my temperature. And when he took my temperature, the thermometer was so cold that I actually broke it. My cheeks were chattering. And they asked me, told me it was my time for me to go. And I said, well, take this guy next to me. He's held up worse off than I am. And so they took him, and everything went all right. They fixed me up. They wrapped me up primarily from head to toe with bandages. So when I was in them, took me to the ward. And, of course, the only problem I had there was the only thing I had open was my mouth. Had a bandage across my whole face, of course. And I had enough room for a spoon to get through. And I had a French nurse that every time she asked me something, which I didn't know what she was saying, she'd stick something in my mouth to eat. And if I tried to tell her no, I'd get something else stuck in my mouth. And that was the only bad part about it. And then about a week later, I had somebody, a doctor I assumed, asked me about my eyes. I said, well, I feel all right. Well, I didn't use particularly nice language about this doctor down there who's going to see about my eye, this colonel. He says, well, we'll see about what we can do. So the next day, they took me down, unbandaged my eyes, and I could see enough to see light and figures. And it turned out the guy I cussed out was the colonel to start with. So anyway, I got away with it. Then we got on the plane. They just happened to put me next to the door, and I was in the top bunk. I didn't have my blankets. They had taken my blankets away from me. I didn't have blankets over my feet. My one foot, my right foot, was almost blue from cold by the time I got to England. And I got off the plane in England. They put us in an ambulance. Now, an English ambulance is about, three decks high, three bunks high. And you ride in it like you're in a ship going through a storm because it rocks back and forth. And you're sure it's going to fall over. Anyhow, we finally get to the hospital. We go in the hospital, and then the only thing I really appreciated there was white sheets, and they gave me a quart of milk. and was first wife seats and quarter milk I've had in almost a year.
I'm struck, and I know that you lived this, and I'm sure there have been many nights you thought about it. You've told the story a few times. But to hear you describe it so matter-of-factly, I can't help but think of how horrifying all of this is. I mean, you're hit to begin with this 88 shell right through your tank. You're incapacitated just about. You find your way out of the tank. You're hit again by mortar fire. You're more concerned about these other guys with it. You're helping take care of them. You end up blind for a few weeks. It's going to take you more than 9 months to recover and get back to health. In those kind of moments, for instance, from 9 in the morning till 5 o'clock, waiting in a hole in the ground that one of the American artillery had made, hoping that someone's going to come rescue you, what do you do for that time? What's going through your mind, and how did you believe that you were actually going to make it through all of this?
Well, I knew I was going to make it. I had no doubts about that. I knew I was bad enough that I might wind up with a leg being off, but that really didn't concern me too much. I was still alive. I was still one piece.
The enemy was still firing your way.
First they got to hit me. So far they haven't hit me.
So it didn't bother you. And it didn't bother you when the buzz bomb hit the hospital and the German prisoners dropped you down a flight of stairs when you're already in all kinds of pain?
A little more pain didn't matter anymore at that time.
Now, whenever I interview a veteran who served in the European theater, I like to ask him about May 8th, 1945, VE Day. The day that part of the war came to an end. Of course, your war ended on February 25th of 45, really. But I think May 8th has some special significance to you, too. Why is that?
That's my day I came back to the United States. I got off with General Huddleston, the hospital ship, in Charleston, South Carolina, on May the 8th at 9 o'clock in the morning, and there was nobody on the dock but the medical personnel and a few Red Cross workers, the buses or whatever it was going to take us to the hospital. They had no celebration or anything else, and we had just been told as we was getting off the ship that the war was over. And that's how where I was on May the 8th. It was right there on the ship, getting off.
Reason to celebrate 80 years ago when victory in Europe was finally secure. Just hearing Mr. Gerhardt's memories and imagining that scene, I'm reminded of how many veterans have shared over the years that they weren't welcomed home by great fanfare. Fast forward a few decades, and men coming home from Vietnam were jeered and harassed and worse. That's one of the reasons the mission of the Honor Flight Network is so important. It's happening in virtually all the areas where this program is heard, so if you haven't checked the Honor Flight schedule in your area yet, you really should. And I want to thank everybody who joined me this last week in Fresno, California, to welcome home 67 veterans on their Central Valley Honor Flight. Seeing what that kind of welcome home really means to the veterans all these years later is all you really need to get hooked. And an Honor Flight organization in your area can certainly use your time and energy and ingenuity, so find a group near you at honorflight.org. When we come back, which Allied soldiers could VE Day have been more meaningful for than those who had become prisoners of war? That perspective and more when this special 80th anniversary VE Day edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5333. 383328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode dedicated to the 80th anniversary of VE Day, Victory in Europe, announced May 8th, 1945. We're going to spend the rest of our time exploring what that meant to those who helped earn that victory, like Richard Christensen, who had been wounded 6 weeks earlier with the 94th Infantry Division.
I was hit up in the left arm, and it took out the tricep.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't by the measure of some wounds. It wasn't really a great wound, but along the way I got sent back to Paris, and then from there back to England. And I think all of that came because of infection. And it took quite a while to... They did some more surgery when I got back to England.
What was that like to be in the hospital and hear, this is over, the Allies have won?
Actually, it was a wonderful experience. First of all, I was in a hospital on Easter that year also. And then the Germans capitulated, and that really was, that was a wonderful feeling. I was at that time able to get around pretty good, and I had met some English people, and it was really wonderful. The first Whitsuntide holiday was right after that. Whitsuntide is, as church people know, Pentecost.
Mm-hmm.
And the English people had not had any days off, any kind of celebrated days, since 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was away on that weekend. And that was really quite an experience to see how happy they were, how much they enjoyed a new kind of freedom. One of the interesting things about my getting out of the hospital, they gave me food stamps for the 10 days leave that I had. And I went to visit a relative of one of my uncles who was from England, and I went to see his sister. And I gave her all those stamps for food.
Mm-hmm.
And she came home the next day and put everything on one plate. She said, that's 10 days worth of stamps.
Wow.
And the English had been going through that since 1939. They were a brave and good people.
Another Purple Heart recipient in London that day was Duke O'Donnell, a B-17 bombardier with the 303rd Bomb Group.
Well, I was on leave that day. I was in London. And we used to get 2 days leave a month. And then we heard that we got 2 extra days because the war was over. So... Somebody said Churchill's going to come out of that building over there. So I stuck around and for a while and didn't come out. But Montgomery, Monty, came out. I saw him, Field Marshal Montgomery, head of the English Army. So, but I never did see Churchill come out.
But that had to be a pretty neat place to be because London had been bombed so much throughout this war, and now victory is won. I bet there are a lot of excited people around.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And London was a real desolate place, almost, parts of it. There would be like blocks after blocks leveled, just nothing but rubble. They take maybe 8 or 9 blocks and take all the rubble off and pile them up in one block. Make a huge pyramid of just old stone and the remains of buildings, rubble, really something to see.
So now that the war is over, I bet you wanted to come home.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, first we thought we'd be going to the Pacific because the war in the Pacific was still going on. So we went to Liverpool and got in a cement boat. When I say cement boat, I don't mean they carried cement. It was made out of cement. There were a few like that. And so we left Liverpool for Boston, and we got out about halfway across the ocean. The war in the Pacific ended. So it took 13 days to come because we broke down, I guess, about half one day, and drifted backwards towards England. That's how I got it. And then they ran out of food at the end, too. But by that time, we didn't care because the last day, all we had to eat was ice cream.
That 20-year-old was just thankful he could eat anything and see anything after what had happened to him 5 months earlier on New Year's Eve.
Well, we went to briefing, of course, which is first before the mission, find out about the target and any defenses they might have down there, how many guns, if they know how many guns they have. Anyway, so then we took off, got flown toward the target, and I started seeing flak. And they had 3 types of ways to shoot flak, straight at the plane, or what they call tracking flak, which is the most accurate. They shoot ahead of you, and on the bomberman you can't deviate from course, so you have to fly right into it. And that was the case in this case. I looked up, and they had either four-gun batteries or six-gun batteries. And up ahead, I saw one shell go off, and then another one closer, and another one closer, and I knew they had at least four, and I knew the next we were going to be right there when I got hit. So I even said over the intercom, we're going to get hit. And the next thing I knew, I thought my head was gone. The top of my head was gone. I just sat there waiting to die. didn't bother me a bit. Anyway, I thought, well, maybe I'm not going to die right away. I can get these bombs out. So I told Mac, I said, tell me when the other ships dropped their bombs. So I was able to feel around. I couldn't see because I had glass in my eye. And he said, there they go. So I felt the toggle switch, which you can get the bombs out that way. And so I got them out that way. And then I was really out of my head for the rest of the day. Maybe ever since, I don't know. But anyway, so Max says, go back to the radio room. So I couldn't see, so I got up, and the top turret gunner, the engineer, helped me along. And I thought to myself, I'll jump out of the plane to make it lighter. They can get back to England easier if I lighten the load up a little bit. You see how I was out of my head. So the engineer, DeWillers, took my parachute off. It was a chest pack, so I could get through the narrow catwalk to the radio room. And but I did have sense enough not to jump out without a parachute, huh? So anyway, I was going to jump out through the bomb bay doors, but anyway. So we went back to the radio room, and then we had to make a forced landing.
I didn't want to interrupt you because I wanted to hear the story from your perspective as you remember it. But people listening are saying, boy, this guy is describing this like it's no big deal. But the first thing you said was all of a sudden, after you saw, you know, one piece of flak closer, another burst closer, you told everyone we're going to get hit. The next thing you know, you thought the top of your head was blown off. So this flak exploded right in the nose of the plane, knocked out the plexiglass, knocked it into your eyes, and you're blind, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. No, couldn't see. The plexiglass, of course, that all crumbled, you know, breaks up in little pieces. I have my face, my eye, and my nose.
So it's basically like buckshot going into your face, only plexiglass.
Yeah, right. That's about it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't see. You're feeling your face. You probably feel a lot of blood, and you really thought that half your head was blown off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
But you stayed at your position to drop your bombs, and this is what your pilot, Bill McLeod, told me was so impressive that inspired the rest of your crew. They all wanted to take you back and give you medical attention. You said, no, I want to drop these bombs. But you're saying that wasn't necessarily a conscious thought, that you were pretty out of it.
You get so trained, I think, to it that dropping the bombs is the one thing you're thinking about. So you don't want to change your mind. You just want to get the bombs out and then figure out I wasn't too sensible either.
Did you ever find out how many pieces of plexiglass they pulled out of you?
No, I don't know. There were quite. There's still one in my nose, but it doesn't bother me any. And so I don't know how many they. You know, they probably threw them away. I don't know.
So the one that's still in your nose, you can feel it internally, or you can rub your finger over it and feel it?
I can feel it right. I'm feeling it right now. Yeah, it's up in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right inside of your left eye, there's a little spot on the bridge of your nose.
Right in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So at the time, you're still there in the bombardier position in the nose. Of course, the glass is shot out. Not that you could see it anyway. You're completely blind, and you needed help from your crew in order to know when to flip that switch and drop the bomb. So how did that work?
Well, I called Mac, the pilot, and said, tell me when the other ships dropped their bombs, because we were in formation. So when the other ones dropped their bombs, I was able to find this, what they call a toggle switch, and got them out that way.
You're just 19 years old at the time. You knew this was dangerous work before you got into it. In your heart of hearts, did you think you'd be coming home? Did you think you were going to see America again?
No, I tell you, the first few weeks there, we were losing planes. Well, we were losing like at least one plane a mission. We had to fly 35 missions, and we put up 39 planes. So I figured, well, my chances of getting back are 4 out of 39. They aren't very good. So I didn't think I was going to make it. I thought it's only a matter of days or weeks or months at the most. And I'm done for. So I didn't think I was going to get back, but I did.
He did, and so did thousands of American prisoners of war who had been dealing with a level of uncertainty and the daily necessity of simple survival that most of us could never come close to fathoming. Ray Maloney was a decorated P-51 pilot who had been starving at Stalag 7A in Moosburg, Germany until it was liberated. On May 7, 1945, he'd been flown to Camp Lucky Strike in Le Havre, France. A special spot in the memories of so many ex-POWs.
Priority for going home was wounded first, and then POWs, and then guys that had done their tours. And Eisenhower came through the camp, and I didn't sit at the table with him. They had these long tables, and they were feeding us five times a day, small meals, but five times a day. And they were trying to put some meat on us because we all looked like skeletons, you know. And that's what the delay was being caused. Was the medics were saying, keep the meal, let's fatten them up before they,
sure,
they go home. And but Eisenhower came through and stopped and had lunch with us. And he was, you know, talking to everybody. And we were saying, General, can we go home? Can we go home? Eisenhower said, well, we're trying to get you home in style. We don't want you to have a rough crossing. But he said, you know, an option we're considering, but we haven't done anything, was to double load you, you know, half sleep and half stay on deck, and then in reverse.
You get twice as many people since the bunks aren't on.
Twice as many on the ships, yeah.
Yeah.
And we said, we don't care, General. Take us home. And so we came home that way, double loaded. They started to move out, I think, the very next day after Eisenhower, you know, gave the word. Another one of my most emotional moments of my military career was we came into New York City, and we was, you know, as I said, the wounded came first, and then the POW. So we were very early in returning, and of course the country was still celebrating, you know, the fact that we had won. And as we're coming up the straits, you know, Staten Island and Brooklyn on one side, you know, the New York Harbor. Along the, on the Brooklyn side, there was a kind of grassy bank, and they had a sign in plants, you know, all very cleverly done. And here I go, I'm going to say, the sign said, welcome home, well done. I'm sorry.
What message could have meant more to you in that moment than that?
It was heaven.
Welcome home. Well done. Isn't it something how four simple words could hold such profound meaning? And it was well done. The courageous service of so many Americans, not to mention our allies, defeated tyranny and reestablished freedom 80 years ago this week. So if you value that freedom, find a VE Day ceremony in your area this week or tune into that 80th anniversary commemoration at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that on VE Day and every day, freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.